I just have to say, I think it's so wonderful on a sermon about hunger that I'm hearing this little baby going snacking. It reminds us of how hungry we all are right from the get-go. It's a beautiful sound. A couple years ago, I visited some friends of mine. They have two preteen children. And that weekend, we drove around together, and the kids were in the back seat, and we were running errands and talking, and then we noticed something. There was silence in the back seat. These kids, who are usually arguing and hitting each other and, you know, running commentary about everything, they were not talking because they were reading. They were absorbed, completely absorbed in a book. So I asked Samuel, "What are you reading?" He said, "Oh, it's The Hunger Games." Well, I didn't know anything about it at the time, but I thought if there is a book other than Harry Potter that can keep two kids quiet for a car ride, I should check it out. And I did check it out. I read all three of the books. I saw the films. And in fact, I saw the last film in the series right here in Appleton at the Marcus Hollywood Theater on Friday. Now, I don't want you to get the impression that I always preach about books and films, because the last time I was here, I talked about To Kill a Mockingbird, and now I'm talking about The Hunger Games. But this one grabbed me in a way that very few others have, because as all good stories do, it points to something both terrible and hopeful about the ways in which we are hungry. I don't think it's a coincidence that the release of this last film of The Hunger Games was set just before Thanksgiving, because it's a time of year when we reflect on harvest and on food, on the abundance of it, or perhaps the lack of it. From concerns to escalating inequality to wondering what we can or should do about it. So before I go down that path, I really want to, and before I riff off of this metaphor of The Hunger Games, I should tell you a little bit about the story for those of you who might not have read it or seen the films. Just curious, how many of you have read the books or seen the films? Fair number of you. Yeah, great. Well, I'm going to summarize this briefly. It's set in a dystopian future in which North America is ruled by a cruel dictator named President Snow, played brilliantly by Donald Sutherland. Under totalitarian rule, the nation is divided into 12 districts, with each district slaving in poverty to produce goods for the excessive appetites of the capital, whose residents exhibit the worst stereotypes of superficial celebrity culture. It's like extreme makeover writ large. Now, there had once been a populist uprising against the capital, but it was squashed and resulted in a tradition called the Hunger Games. And that was designed to punish the districts and remind them of the price of rebellion. And what better or worse way to remind them than to involve the sacrifice of their children? Because each year a lottery is held, one teenage boy, one teenage girl from each district are selected to participate in the games and fight each other to the death. It's survivor on steroids. The winner of the Hunger Games gets a lifetime of individual personal comfort and a year's worth of slightly better than starvation rations for his or her district. So the narrative of the film is set in motion when the lottery is held to select the tributes, and Katniss Everdeen, who lives in District 12, which is one of the poorest and hungriest districts in all of Penem, Katniss's sister, Primrose, was selected, and Katniss volunteers to take her place, knowing that if Prim actually was in the Hunger Games, she would not survive. The boy selected from District 12 is Peyta Mellark. He is a kind of a doughy, gentle boy, the son of a baker. Together, they go into the arena, and throughout the course of the three novels, they take on the culture of oppression, who literally feed to excess the rich and the obedient citizens of the capital, and starve to near death the rest of the world. So that's the summary of the books and the movies. And as with all really good science fiction or future-oriented novels and stories, there is a sharp critique of the world as it stands today, in a world where literally thousands, if not millions of people are starving, some to death, in a world where we actually have enough food to feed everybody. So The Hunger Games is not only about oppression through starvation, but it's also a powerful indictment of much of today's culture, of the use of violence as entertainment, of using media for propaganda, of our appetite to watch other people's suffering, and of the profound disparities between the haves and the have-nots, of the terrible ways in which the competition for food or clean water have pitted nations against nation and people against people. And it deals also with themes that are very close to the heart of our Unitarian Universalist faith, themes like personal integrity and the value of human life, the value of human worth. So I was thinking about this the other day. I pulled up to a stoplight at the end of a freeway ramp. Maybe this has happened to you too. There on the side of the road was a man with a sign that said, "Hungry, please help." And as always, I was clutched with several immediate and deeply conflicted emotions. My first thought, I'm not proud to say this, but my first thought was, I hope the light changes quickly so I don't have to deal with this. But it didn't. I sat there. He stood there. I looked at him through the window. He looked back at me. And that day I had a handful of pennies right there and a $20 bill in my purse in the back seat. So to give him pennies, that seemed insulting. To give him money would require stopping the car or reaching back for my purse in the back seat. That was awkward and difficult. So that particular day, I looked as sympathetic as I could muster, and I gave him a brief nod of acknowledgement and then drove on. Now, I'm not proud of that. I'd like to tell you, as one of your ministers, that I pulled over the car and I stopped what I was doing, and I would talk to him, asking about his story, what led him as a human being to make his living by holding a cardboard sign that said, "I'm hungry, please help." And I will say I've tried to be better prepared for that moment now. I have a grocery card and a gas card in my wallet to give away, but there still lingers a profound sense of sadness and anger within me. Not for him, but that this is the way that he earned his daily bread. Been faced with the same guilty dilemma, knowing that whatever you do is a drop in the ocean of the entire sequence of circumstances, events, choices, decisions that led to that moment by the side of the road. Maybe you have responded to the calls from the Hunger and Homelessness Action Team right here at the fellowship, providing or serving meals at the warming shelter, participating in the empty to full pan project, serving meals at the Homeless Connection. That is all to the good, of course. People are hungry right now. That is a need that has to be addressed. And I have to tell you, one of the things I've been so impressed by about this fellowship is that you actually work hard to make that third part of your mission statement real, to lead in social justice. Your leadership around this issue of hunger and homelessness and some of the ongoing and tireless work of the social justice ministry teams is inspiring and necessary. And one of the most important things, I think, about being a member of a church as an institution, and this fellowship in particular, is that it provides you with opportunities to serve needs greater than your own, to get involved from the micro to the macro levels of change, from dealing with the immediate needs of people with hunger and the causes of hunger, which is poverty, to the larger systemic issues of income inequality. America's own 21st century version of The Hunger Games. So I wonder, how bad is it really? How many people are hungry in this nation? About 14% of American households are food insecure, which translates to about 17.4 million people. When you look at a pie chart, and there always seem to be pie charts about these things, you see how even that begins to break down into households who have enough food, those who have barely enough, and about 7 million people, probably like my friend by the side of the road, who are what's called very low food security. Wisconsin fares better than Ohio in that food insecurity in Ohio falls above the U.S. average, and it's in Wisconsin, it's below the U.S. average. I'm convinced it's because of the hard work of the fellowship here and the Hunger and Homelessness Task Force and the warming shelters and organizations like that. But the obvious question here is there just not enough food to feed everybody? And the answer is an unequivocal no. According to the World Food Program, there is enough food to feed everyone in the world today, to have enough nourishment for a healthy and productive life. At the same time, here in the United States, more than 48 million Americans rely on what used to be called food stamps, now called SNAP. And Congress, just last fall, voted to cut $5 million from SNAP, a decision that directly affects people's ability to eat. I don't think there's a coincidence between the Hunger Games author Suzanne Collins naming the Capitol as the axis of corruption and our own halls of injustice in Washington, D.C. So the relationship between hunger and poverty, it cannot be overstated. Hungry people are poor people, and the face of poverty is something we'd prefer not to see or talk about, particularly in our political sphere. I tried to think about the last time that poverty was front and center on the national agenda, and it was over 50 years ago, the President Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty in 1964. That was such a hopeful time, when all things seemed possible. Civil rights movements galvanized a whole host of other human rights movements, including the rights of poor people. The movement was gaining momentum. There was a belief that we as a nation could take on poverty and fix it. Johnson boldly declared, "We shall not rest until the war is won." And at that time, people were talking about not just the concerns of the middle class, but of the poor. I remember even children could participate in this great American conversation about the poor. The picture on the monitor behind me, admittedly, this is creepy. I just want to acknowledge it. But this doll was produced in 1965 for only 1 year, the year after Johnson made his big war on poverty speech, with the probably naive belief that some little girls would be interested in the plight of the poor and want to have this doll. I did. This is my doll. I still have her. Her name is Susie Sad Eyes. And I knew when I saw this doll in the discount bin of a thrift store that I had to have her. I think my liberal leanings were even evident back then. I wanted to rescue her, give her a home, ensure that she would never be hungry again. She now sells on eBay for over hundreds of dollars. Get out of here. That's right, right. If I hadn't chopped her hair, it would have been even more. But I tried to get her to be friends with Barbie and Ken, but they were only interested in jet setting off to Miami and their convertible. So Barbie and Ken are long gone. Susie Sad Eyes, well, she's still here, and she's still poor. So in 1964, the poverty rate was about 19%. Today, it's approximately 14.5. If there is good news here, it's that the rate of those living in poverty has not increased. But what has increased is a growing gnawing divide between the very rich and the very poor and the struggling and often sinking middle class. The hungriest game of our time is actually unchecked capitalism that is supported by a web of policies, corporate globalization, of free trade, of outsourcing, of privatization, of tax shifting and evasion, of subsidies, of bailouts, of deregulation, of decline of support for public institutions, many of which our Unitarian and Universalist ancestors created, worked for, established. At the 2014 General Assembly in Providence, Rhode Island, the topic of escalating inequality was selected to be the congregational study action issue for the next 4 years. So we're in year two. And some churches are doing an all-church read of the book Beyond Outrage by former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich as a way of exploring the systemic issues of poverty and hunger in a land of plenty, and of this escalating inequality, this great divide of class. Reich cites seven major factors as to why economic challenges facing the United States today are systemic. This is a snapshot. One, for the last three decades, almost all of America's economic growth has gone to the wealthiest 1%. The Great Recession of 2008 was followed by an anemic recovery because America's middle class is so much in debt. Three, political clout and power has flowed to the top. Politicians are forced to rely on contributions from lobbyists and its wealthiest citizens. Four, corporations are paying less tax and receiving more government handouts. Five, government budgets are squeezed, resulting in less revenue for public institutions. Six, Americans are competing with one another for slices of that shrinking pie. And seven, a meaner and more cynical politics prevails. Reich writes that the game is rigged and we all know it. He says, quote, a profound change has come over America. Guts, gumption, and hard work don't seem to pay off as they once did. Instead, the game seems rigged in favor of people who are already rich and powerful, and as well as their children. So instead of lionizing the rich, we're beginning to suspect they gained their wealth by ripping us off. What do you do? How do you change the rules of the game? In the Hunger Games, it seemed impossible to change any of the rules. And in the books and the film, The Hunger Games, Katniss Everdeen offers two strategic ploys that change the course of their history forever. Nearing the end of the first Hunger Games, she and PETA are pitted against each other. They are supposed to kill one another because there can only be one tribute, according to the rules of that game. Katniss and PETA decide they are not going to play by the capital's rules any longer, believing that if both of their lives can't be spared, then both of their lives should be sacrificed. Well, this move would destroy the entertainment value of their battle. So the capital intervenes at the last minute and spares them both, at least until the second book. Now, I can't tell you the second move that Katniss makes because it would be a giant spoiler alert for those of you who haven't seen the book or haven't seen the movie or read the book. But I can tell you that it goes right at the heart of everything that is evil with the capitalisms, a system that puts money and power above the ordinary people, above the ability of ordinary people to live lives of meaning and purpose without extraordinary want. It's a short little book. It's a fascinating read. And at the end of Reich's book, he concludes with a little-known speech by President Obama at Osawatomie, Kansas, in 2011. In it, Obama writes this. He says, "It's heartbreaking that there are millions of working families in this country who are now forced to take their children to food banks to get a decent meal. But fortunately, that is not a future we have to accept. There is another view about how to build our future. It's not a view, and this is important, it's not a view that says we should punish profit or success, or pretend that the government knows how to fix all of society's problems. It's a view that says in America, we are greater together. When everyone engages in fair play, everyone gets a fair shot, everyone does their fair share." End quote. What can we do? Well, we can work on the micro level, of course. As we said, providing meals, food. We can educate ourselves about the insidious and intersecting lines of inherited poverty, racism, greed, and the theology of scarcity that creates a permanent underclass. We can vote for candidates, both nationally and even more importantly, locally, who are naming this issue as part of their platform and can be aware of our own hunger. We can be aware of our own hunger. I am hungry for a country that actually names the escalating inequality between the haves and the have-nots as a national priority. And I am hungry for a country in which food pantries do not exist any longer because everyone has enough food to eat. There's a brilliant and important speech from 1967, Dr. Martin Luther King at the Riverside Church in New York City, where he says the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today is the United States. And to save itself, the U.S. must lead an international crusade against poverty, racism, and militarism. And to do that, he said, we have got to have a reconstruction of society. We've got to have a revolution of values. A society that truly believes in the reality of abundance. That abundance, I will add, that we sang about in our opening hymn, that everywhere a feast is spread, that's always at our side. This revolution of values, values that are near and dear to the heart of Unitarian Universalists, values that our ancestors and other liberal religious faiths have worked for. A living wage, quality public education, affordable health care, and for God's sake, enough food to eat in a land of plenty. A revolution of values is required if these so-called ideals can be made real in this country. We need to get hungry for that and demand an end to these hunger games once and for all.